This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Jan Willem Janssens. He's an ecological planner with Ecotone. Jim Madison, who's restoration director at Wild Earth Guardians, and Roger Taylor of the Galisteo Community Association, were here to talk about an ecological restoration of Galisteo Creek at the Galisteo Bosque in the village over there. And first of all, welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this is a really interesting project because we're talking about a 3/4 of a mile section of creek, and it took you, what, 5 centuries to get it? I mean, it took forever to get it done.
That's right. Well, the beginning of the project was actually around 2000 when we started the Galisteo Watershed Restoration Project with Earthworks Institute, and we had a community meeting in Galisteo, I think the first one even in 1998, where we identified Galisteo as one of the areas where work could be done and where the landowners were really interested in work, particularly in the Bosque. And then in 2006, with a state grant for wetland restoration and wetland identification in the Galisteo Basin, we got some money and identified the Galisteo Bosque as one of the major wetlands in the Galisteo Basin.
Tell us for a moment what's so important about wetlands in general and those wetlands in particular.
Well, wetlands are important ecological features in any landscape, but particularly here in the Southwest because of the, you could say, contrast between higher and drier areas and then the lower wetter areas. So a lot of the plant diversity and therefore also a lot of the wildlife and bird diversity is dependent on these wet areas. And we have different kinds of wetlands in Santa Fe County, actually. We have wetlands that are exclusively fed by rainwater, and then you get the playas, of which we have just one south of Galisteo, for instance. But there are also wetlands that are fed by underground water that seeps out of rocks, and then you have slope wetlands, of which we have several, for instance, around La Cienega. And then you have wetlands that are fed by stream water, by actually underground water in streams or by overbank flooding. And that is the kind that we have in Galisteo and its Bosque. And that starts actually about a mile north of Galisteo, where we have a volcanic ridge that creates a geologic situation that permits a permanent flow of water through the Galisteo Creek in Galisteo, and that continues for several miles downstream. And this entire area of about 3 or 4 miles is one extended multi-hundred acre wetland area that is permanently wetted.
Now, what kinds of animals do you see there?
Well, we have a very large variety of both permanent resident and migratory birds, and going from just your regular, you know, coming through birds, your normal area birds, but all the way up to, we have a resident nesting pair, great horned owls. We've got raptors, we've got hawks, we've got barn owls, we've got a bunch of owls like that. To just land animals, there's a mountain lion in the area, there's a cougar. So we have a wide variety of animals that are living and using that bosque.
So there's a lot of reasons to preserve or restore a wetland like this. First of all, and maybe Jim, you can talk to this, what was wrong with it that it needed to be restored? In other words, what had happened? How was it degraded?
Well, with the introduction of non-native species into riparian systems, invasive species have the capacity to outcompete native vegetation, and often native vegetation is used used by wildlife for forage species. So the wildlife species continue to use native vegetation, and the non-native vegetation is not utilized, and so it outcompetes the native vegetation. And then you start to develop monocultures of invasive vegetation, which alter erosion processes and other geomorphological processes that happen along streams. And so when you get to that point where you have a monoculture of invasive species, it really degrades water quality and wildlife habitat.
What kind of species are we talking about? I mean, is this mainly Russian olive trees or other things as well?
Well, the main players are always in the Southwest are going to be Russian olive. There's also going to be Siberian elm and salt cedar. All three species are present in the Galisteo Basin, and were impacting Galisteo Creek.
It's such an irony that Russian olives, were you saying before we started, Roger, that Russian olives were brought in to stabilize rivers?
Well, a lot of them were brought in for ornamental purposes because they look and sound good.
They smell great so good in the spring.
And they're, you know, they fairly hardy. They adapt to environments very easily. But they're also brought in for erosion purposes because they have a very deep, resilient root ball. The problem is, though, that as they mature, they crowd out, as Jim was saying, all the native species. But they also take a huge amount of water.
Yeah.
And they take an enormous amount of nutrients out of the soil. And that's all damaging to the more native species.
So the idea is to take out Russian olive, salt cedar, Siberian elm. What's the problem? You can't just go in and take it out?
Well, I want to add actually to the story too that when we started looking at the Galisteo Creek and Galisteo, particularly about 10 plus years ago, that we saw that a lot of these trees that were crowding out the native vegetation created islands of sediment, and that created a topography like a difference between high and low along the creek that prevented in certain locations the creek to top over the higher banks, so that actually a high flow would stay in the channel and start carving the bottom of the channel and erode it out and become kind of a narrow, deeper channel, especially at the bottom end, the lower end of the bosque.
So it made the creek deeper?
It made the creek deeper, and it made the banks higher because in a very high flow, it would drop more sediment between the trees. So what that does then is that in combination with reduced chances for that water to irrigate, you could say, the wider bosque because it cannot flow over the bank as easily because of its own sediment, you could say. And the second part is that these trees grow there that suck so much water out, as Roger said, that the bosque was gradually drying up. And as the bosque dries up, more of the species that we don't want start growing there, and the native species like willows and cottonwoods can no longer grow there.
Yeah.
And they crowd out the grasses, so you get a very kind of wild, non-natural situation. And just downstream, a local famous horticulturist who lived in Santa Fe and died maybe 10, 15 years ago, Bill Isaacs, identified a wild orchid in the late 90s. And so our dream and hope has been to see if we could recreate these wetland circumstances where this wild orchid, the Utes lady tress, could actually be brought back. And so that was one of the, you could say, iconic ecological conditions that require frequent flooding, disturbance by nature and not by people, that and create a wetland situation. And so we've been looking at bringing back more natural variability of water and flooding and erosion in that wetland situation. And therefore, also these trees needed to be removed. The ecology of the landforms, the high-low differences needed to be adapted, which the creek will do now that there is less vegetation. And with that then, we will have more of a chance to create the native vegetation to attract more wildlife to go through this area because it was so dense that deer and cougar and bobcats and whatever you have probably had difficulty getting through. And the Galisteo Creek and the Bosque there is a very important pathway for wildlife from north to south and south to north across the Galisteo Basin.
Yeah, that's something we've talked a lot about. Wildlife corridors, they have to travel the same way we use I-25 in order to get where they're going seasonally. And it's yet another one of those examples for people who don't necessarily, you know, have a knowledge of what an area might have looked like decades ago. It looks like nature. It's beautiful, but it's not natural because it's full of these invasive species, and they need to be taken out in order to restore what is in fact natural to that area. So then you have this question of not only how do you do it, but how do you get the bureaucratic permissions necessary to do it? And we start out by saying that this took a really long time. It didn't take a long time because it was so difficult to accomplish. It was difficult to accomplish from the perspective of getting all those permits necessary. How did you, first of all, what was that like?
Well, I think that it really begins with understanding that we're working on private land and that we're dealing with, I think, 19 private properties.
19 property owners.
And so on a stretch of river of not even a mile with 19 property owners and getting everybody to understand and to appreciate what we wanted to do, the purpose, the methods, and the expected outcome, and to then, once everybody is on board, getting the funding, and the funders typically want to hear again from the private landowners and so on. That is an enormous process. And then go through the regulatory requirements of archaeological surveys, Army Corps surveys regarding wetlands, because the Army Corps is the agency in this country that protects wetlands under the Clean Water Act.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the county has an entire series of regulations that we have to adhere to that, again, are grafted on federal and state regulations. So we had an entire battery of regulatory stuff to work through. And
we were also juggling two other departments, the State Environment Department, as well as the Office of the State Engineer, who also had their own requirements and regulatory process for us to go through.
So how did you navigate all of that? Roger, you as from
a lot of patience and sometimes not.
Well, I mean, you're a complete volunteer, Roger, from the Galisteo Community Association,
right?
And you were working with all these other landowners. But it seems just crazy that in order to do what seems like should be something that everybody wants, you have to jump through so many hoops.
It is, and it is definitely frustrating. I think the experience that we had, and it took me from the time I got involved over 5 years to make this happen, and Jim will tell you, and Wild Earth Guardians did a phenomenal job of not only organizing it and having it ready when we finally got the go and having the staff in there. And it was a six-week process for taking out hundreds and hundreds of these Russian olives and other pieces. And yet it took us 5 years, and Jan Willem was working on this before that. And we'd have holds put on the funds would get transferred from one department to another. We actually had to put together a memo of understanding between one department to another when they should have been able to do it themselves. Luckily I have that corporate background, so I was able to think through how do you transfer money between departments and things.
Oh my goodness.
Because they didn't seem to know how to do that. And then we had all the regulatory process. So it was very frustrating. And I think the big thing that my discovery was that people want to help. They want these things to happen, but they don't seem to have either the ability or the willingness to step out of their job definitions of what they have to do. And it may just be partly, I think, too, a lack of staff and a lack of time and too much to do. But that step of helping you get to the next step, you know, I swear if Jan Willem and I hadn't been partnering on this and doing all those extra steps, this project never would have happened.
Yeah. So we're talking about the restoration of 3/4 of a mile of bosque along the Galisteo Creek. Now, Jim Madison, tell us about Wild Earth Guardian's role in all of this.
Well, for over 15 years, Wild Earth Guardians has had a restoration program that focuses on restoring wildlife habitat and restoring riparian habitat and improving water quality. And so we have conducted more than 50 projects over the last 15 years, and so we really have developed a specialty towards. We do some non-native removal, but our focus is really about putting native plant material back into these ecosystems to really allow them to do what they've done for tens of thousands of years before human activities altered these landscapes. And so, our focus is, let's recreate the conditions that allow these native systems to flourish again. And so the project focused on mechanical extraction of the non-native species, getting all the root wads, all the roots just chasing down secondary root systems so there's no resprouts, which invasive species are notorious for. They have a will to want to survive, and so you really have to chase down that. And then the project focused on planting thousands of native willow near stream side to provide that shade for the stream, and to provide and to plant some cottonwoods to recreate the overstory where there were lapses because of the removal of the non-native vegetation. And then we went in and planted hundreds of forage bearing species such as chokecherry and New Mexico olive and American plum and golden currant to provide forage for wildlife species that utilize this corridor.
So now that work is done, and it's a huge accomplishment that is made up of many unsung heroes, although we're trying to sing them today on this program, but now that it's done, is the ecosystem self-sustaining? Do you have to do follow-up to make sure that those other non-native invasive species are really gone? Like, what happens now?
What will happen now is that we have to track what's happening, really, because it is a very dynamic system with where we don't know how much flooding will happen, how much erosion will happen, basically how big the floods will be. And
because of climate change,
exactly,
drought, any other variables.
Exactly. And so it is also a situation that is not 100% natural anymore, because the creek used to flow 20, 25 feet higher 125 years ago as a result probably of the railroad that was built upstream along the Galisteo Creek. The Galisteo Creek was narrowed tremendously and dug itself into its riverbed. And in Galisteo now, that meant that there are steep banks of 20, 25 feet tall along this creek, and it cannot freely meander anymore, although over the last 125 years it has created for itself a floodplain of 100, 150 yards wide that we have tried to now make more accessible by taking out these trees and offering the floodwaters more space to flow over. So with that, it is like Jim mentioned, that we want to give nature more of its natural capacity to heal what nature creates.
Yeah.
And in a wetland, the natural processes are very strong to do that. And so we have studied and learned a lot about wetlands over the last 15 years. And we is a wide network of practitioners, including the state of New Mexico. And I really want to give them credit with the Surface Water Quality Bureau and their wetland program, mm-hmm. specifically Marianne McGraw, Karen Manitre, Emile Sawyer, who works there right now, who provide the oversight and the technical assistance that the Office of the State Engineer couldn't provide when we got the funding for this. So, and that was what Roger talked about, that actually initially we got funding in 2004, 5, 6 from the wetlands program that got stalled because of a land dispute in Galisteo on water issues. And part because that community was a land grant, some land boundaries weren't quite defined, and that led to the dispute. So that dried up part of the funding. Then we got new funding, and that dried up again in the collapse of an organization that I was with, Earthworks Institute. And so then we had to transfer that money. So a third time we tried to get it, and we got it again through a state appropriation from the past Senator Griego and the late Representative Easley. And that money was parked with the Office of the State Engineer, but then we got help from the Surface Water Quality Bureau, the Wetlands Program particularly, to start working on this because they had more experience in managing those grants. And I want to explain this because that is the complexity of these kind of projects these days. And the money was not enough. So then Jim and I went out and got money from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But that had to be managed in a different way and require a new set of regulatory requirements. Although I also must give credit to the Fish and Wildlife Service because they helped us tremendously by doing, for instance, an archaeological survey that needed to be done, and a biological survey, and an identification of nesting birds. That all was wrapped up in their technical assistance. So we should not forget that. And then we had to partner Biohabitats, who did the engineering component for everything, so that we can pass the Army Corps and the county permitting. So
I'm exhausted.
So, but it is really important for all of us to understand how diverse a partnership needs to be to get this done, to actually then open up the powers of Mother Nature to then do with this landscape what it's supposed to do.
Right.
And what we're going to do is, like going back to your question, watch what's happening. And we have submitted another grant with the Surface Water Quality Bureau to see if we can get some more money to remove some more trees and maybe do some minor, you could say, tweaks to help Mother Nature do what it needs to do and not keep that water in an entrenched channel like it is at some places right now. And then there are certain, and that is another thing that actually maybe Jim can explain, that we have learned in the past that we cannot just cut those trees. We had to extract the roots.
Yeah, I mean, I, as I mentioned previously, the mechanical extraction in these and removing non-native vegetation is critical, especially we as an organization, and I think all of the landowners were not interested in using herbicide treatments to do any of this work, which is an alternative method of treating invasive vegetation. But we wanted to do it more holistically and to remove all the non-native species with a little impact to the native vegetation as possible. And so thereby, bringing in heavy equipment, which is a large endeavor to actually remove, root wads of up to 24-inch diameter trees is quite extensive. And so, not only that, then you have to break down that biomass, the limbs of the tree, the trunk of the tree, and then you have the root wads themselves, which we have to get out of the floodplain, and they have to be transported to waste transfer stations in the county. So it's all quite a large undertaking.
This project fascinates me because it represents both an incredible success in the sense that all these landowners and all these agencies and all these organizations worked together to accomplish a restoration. On the other hand, it points to a much bigger problem, which is that who knows how many hundreds, if not thousands, of miles of wetlands and rivers and riparian areas need equally loving and careful restoration. And if it takes this to do 3/4 of a mile, it seems impossible or daunting, or, I mean, just, so much red tape to cut through. And of course, this regulation was put in place in the first place in order to prevent other kinds of greater harm and greater destruction. But it points to something that I've been thinking about a lot, which is this question. I don't think it's even really a word, but I think of it as debureaucratization. Like, how do you actually create a system that is less bureaucratic and gets the right things done, but still doesn't allow exploitation of land and water, which those regulations were supposed to do in the first place?
Well, it's interesting. I've actually had a thought about that. We did get, I have to say, working with Karen Minitry was really great because she was from the surface water from the Environment Department and Surface Water Bureau. And she did reach out and work with the Office of the State Engineer so that we didn't have to do as much of that. But I think, you know, looking at the governor's water stewardship program that she's got, and funded a couple of years ago, that a really excellent idea would be to hire one or two people who played the roles that I and Jan Willem did, because basically we were the ones who kept this going. We kept all the coordination, but it was a huge learning process because we don't work for those organizations and don't know how to connect them all and get them all together, and they've got the requirements of their own jobs to do.
Yeah.
So I think if you had somebody like that and their whole job was just to look at, here's this project, here are these five or six or seven different agencies, et cetera, that have to work with it, I'm the person in that role that has to be the coordinator to pull all this together and figure out how it works and how to make it happen. And to go to your point, there was a report that was issued a couple of months ago by the state, and it shows, it basically was stating that this is an enormous issue throughout the entire state of New Mexico, and particularly with the Russian olive invasion of bosques and riparian areas in small towns, etc., throughout the state. So it's a massive issue, and it does need to be addressed. One of the other things that we didn't mention in going to the climate change issue, we had a huge support from the fire department, because as these Russian olives mature and begin to continue to spread, and they kill off this other vegetation, you begin to start having an enormous fire hazard. And in our drier climate, with these then intensive periodic rainstorms, not only do you get the erratic flooding kinds of conditions, but you also have major fire conditions.
How does the Russian olive invasion lead to fire conditions?
Because it kills off a lot of the other undergrowth. It kills off, crowds together your natural willows, and you get big clumps of them and they die off. You can't get to them with equipment because you've got trees in the way. And then you get all this other underbrush that comes in.
So the trees that the Russian olives, et cetera, have killed are then waiting to catch fire?
Well, what happens is you have the great possibility of what's called a canopy fire.
Among what trees?
Among all the cottonwoods that are there, because we have a huge amount of cottonwoods in the area. So you've got a deep bosque, you've got cottonwoods down there, and you've got a huge canopy up on top. And so the problem is, one of the biggest issues in New Mexico now are canopy fires.
Right.
And so it goes through there, and you've got all that dry kindling just ready to go and take out all the really good trees that you want to keep.
Right, and you have dry brush and grass all around the bosque.
Right.
So if just somebody flicks a cigarette, or if a backyard little fire escapes in a dry year and gets to that bosque, then it climbs through the brush into the dead brush underneath the crowding trees, and then from there into the canopies.
Right, right.
And that is the problem. We've seen several of those already happening in Española, in Albuquerque
already this year.
That is definitely a major risk that we have also averted now in Galisteo.
Roger Taylor, you're with the Galisteo Community Association. Now that it's done, how are all these landowners liking it?
Pretty much they love it. A number of people have commented it's a little open. They'd like to see some more plantings. And so we're hoping if we get the additional funding, we can do that. But I've had comments from people who've been there 70, 80 years that it looks like the way it was when they used to play in the bosque when they were 5 years old.
Nice.
It's open, it's area. And, you know, again, it also goes to there's a lot of aging communities out there, and we're one of them. And so it's a lot more accessible for people to walk. And we have a large walking and dog contingent. So it makes it a lot more accessible for them to be able to go down there and not have to worry so much about falling or getting access.
And there are a lot of birders. Actually, it was an Audubon study center for many years where they did the Christmas bird count, and I think even the summer bird count, or what is it, the migratory bird count,
right,
that's normally happening on May 16th. And so we are very interested in seeing what the wildlife and bird population will do right now. And the Fish and Wildlife Service that gave us the money, as I mentioned, also finances the monitoring component that we're going to do. The monitoring means that you track the ecological condition. And so we are going to install wildlife cameras next week. And so we're going to see with the cameras what wildlife is coming through the bosque. And we have already in the past done trackers workshops there, and we have some idea what species are there. And now from now on, we can see whether gradually that number of wildlife is increasing. We have the bird counts from the past, so we can also see whether the bird count is changing. And then from annual or maybe twice per year follow-up walks that we're going to do, we're going to see whether the vegetation and the stream floor, you could say, is going to change so that actually the floods can flow more over the banks and spread across and support native vegetation that is attractive for the wildlife. And that is really important, and that is being supported also by the Santa Fe Watershed Association, because they hold that Fish and Wildlife Service grant for us. And I wanted to make that sure, make sure that I said that so that people really understand how broad this partnership is.
Quite amazing, almost overwhelming. And I want to just say a sort of public thank you to the three of you and everybody else who was involved with this project, and may it be an inspiration to others in New Mexico.
Well, one important thing that I want to add for Roger, and you have a detail on that, besides fire management, wildlife, and also water resource management,
right,
because the Galisteo Bosque is a drinking water source for the community well in Galisteo. It's also an economic resource.
Yes. We are actually in a process of looking at some revitalization efforts for the village. After the 2008 financial collapse, we had some businesses. They all closed. So we are in the process. We've been restoring an old dance hall. It's one of the last of seven remaining dance halls in the state, and we are opening it this Friday. We're having a grand opening as a gallery for the artist in Galisteo.
Are you going to have dance?
We're not. Well, we're going to have small exhibits throughout the year, probably flamenco and things like that. But primarily this gallery is going to be for the artists. About two-thirds of the people living Galisteo are artists of some type. So Friday night we'll be having our grand opening of the building as a gallery. We're still restoring the building, but we're about 90% done. And we are in the Frontiers program, which is a subset of Main Street, which is for small towns that are trying to bring back some sort of commercial element, a coffee shop, a convenience store, a restaurant, things like that. So the Bosque was part of this program because we had to basically bring in a nature element for Audubon and other people. And it was also developing the last couple of years a major mosquito problem. And by opening it up like this, we're hoping we're going to be reducing that mosquito element quite a bit and make the outdoors a little bit more inviting.
Well, it's just about time to go, but I want to thank all of you for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Jan Willem Janssens is an ecological planner. He's with Ecotone. Roger Taylor from the Galisteo Community Association. Jim Madison joining us by phone. He's restoration director for Wild Earth Guardians. If people want to find out more about this project, how do they do so?
They can contact me by email, and that is jwjanssens@gmail.com. And they can contact, I suppose, the Galisteo.
They can contact me, Roger Taylor, at clearskynm, short for New Mexico, @gmail.com.
Okay. And if any of you can't quite get that, just write to me, radiocafe@ksfr.org, and I will connect people, which happens quite a lot on this show. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.